Good evening. In the news tonight, as the war in Iraq to take back Mosul from ISIL rages on, up to 1 million people could be displaced.
The U.S. has choices to make about its participation, like how high a bar it's going to put on the Iraqi government in terms of protection of civilians in Mosul.
Outrage over a police killing of a 66-year-old woman in the Bronx.
This tragedy is so shocking.
Tonight, Clinton and Trump debate, but what will most likely be left out?
There hasn't been one question asked about climate change in any of the three debates. It is widely believed in some quarters that climate change obviously is the most existential issue of our time. It is not something that can be managed or ameliorated like debt entitlement reform or ISIS. It is something that will quite literally end life as we know it, and it's not something that's come up once.
With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Wednesday, October 19th, 2016. Beginning with international news, there is an agreement for a 72-hour ceasefire in Yemen. It will take effect shortly before midnight this evening. The hope is after this time period, the ceasefire would be renewed and made permanent. Daniel Johnson reports.
The announcement of a three-day halt to the fighting in Yemen cannot come soon enough for millions of desperately vulnerable people. But it's not nearly long enough, says Jamie McGoldrick, UN representative in the Arabian Peninsula country. Here he is, speaking from the capital, Sana'a.
By having just access in 72 hours, you interrupt your planning by diverting attention somewhere else. Whereas if we can have those areas open at all times, then we can plan differently and we can supply better.
One of the key priorities once the pause in fighting begins is getting aid to people in the city of Taiz. It's on the front line of the conflict between government forces and Houthi rebels. Some 600,000 people have been displaced by the fighting in the central Yemeni city, the UN says, in a plea for funding from the international community. Other places that need urgent help include Marad and the capital Sana'a, where airstrikes were reported on Wednesday. In addition to the violence, Yemen now faces another threat, cholera. The first cases were confirmed 3 weeks ago in Sana'a, and there are now hundreds more suspected infections. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
In Iraq, the U.S.-backed government and Kurdish forces are on day three of the assault on Mosul in an attempt to take it back from Daesh, ISIL.
We're in the midst of a story that began with the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and arguably before.
Robert Naiman is policy director with Just Foreign Policy.
At this particular juncture, it's hard to imagine the U.S. Not being involved, given its relationship with the Iraqi government, given the perceived stakes for the U.S. of eliminating territorial control of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. I think the U.S. at this point, U.S. involvement is fait accompli. What I think should be our focus, to the extent that we have any energy or attention or desire to improve the world, is how that U.S. involvement is going to play out. I can't imagine any scenario in which the U.S., you know, now walks away from what's going on in Iraq. But the U.S. has choices to make about its participation, like how high a bar is going to put on the Iraqi government in terms of protection of civilians in Mosul. That's very much an open question. And many, many, many lives hang in the balance.
The UN says in a worst-case scenario, 1 million people could be displaced by the Mosul campaign, requiring emergency housing and food. It warned that some 100,000 people may arrive in Syria from the Mosul area.
These things are all happening under the aegis of the United States. So as Americans, we have some responsibility for this, right? The United States is a partner in this operation. The United States has an obligation to see to it that civilians are protected. And unfortunately, right now, there's kind of a dynamic of hurry. President Obama is about to leave office. He's gotten a lot of criticism for not being tough enough on ISIS. There's a sense that, you know, the clock is ticking and the U.S. wants to finish this operation. And so there's a tendency to cut corners as far as protecting civilians is concerned. So in that context, it, both because of the history and because of the current climate, there is every reason to be very afraid about what's going to happen to civilians in Mosul.
Save the Children said 5,000 people have fled to a refugee camp in northeastern Syria from the Mosul area in the last 10 days, with another 1,000 waiting to enter at the border. The group said the overwhelmed camp is littered with waste and feces, with a looming risk of outbreaks of disease. It said there are just 16 latrines shared by more than 9,000 people, many of whom have access to dirty, untreated water. The group says conditions there are among the worst we've seen, and we expect thousands more to be on their way soon. Amina Saeed Hassan is a Yazidi women's rights activist from Sinjar in northern Iraq. She says 400,000 of her people have been displaced by ISIL, and she's concerned about the future.
It's very difficult, especially for us, because many people in Mosul and our neighbor, they join ISIS. So after liberation, how it will be? How we can live together again?
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. In local news, Mayor Bill de Blasio today addressed the death of Deborah Danner, shot by the NYPD in the Bronx last night.
Deborah Danner, 66 years old, and known to the NYPD as someone who suffered from mental illness. And the shooting of Deborah Danner is tragic, and it is unacceptable. It should never have happened. Simple as that. It should never have happened.
Police responded to a neighbor's complaint that Deborah Danner was behaving in an irrational manner. This was in the Castle Hill section of the Bronx. Police said they found Danner in a bedroom holding a pair of scissors, threatening cops. Sergeant Hugh Barry entered her seventh-floor apartment and convinced her to drop the scissors, but she grabbed a wooden bat, and the cop grabbed his gun and shot the woman. Even though Barry had a taser, he went for the gun and fired 3 shots. He is now placed on modified duty, stripped of his gun and shield, pending an investigation. De Blasio says in 2016, 128,000 calls went to the NYPD related to an emotionally disturbed person, that the NYPD overwhelmingly handles these situations very well with tremendous skill and sensitivity.
That's why this tragedy is so shocking, because it veers so clearly away from what we have seen so often from the members of the NYPD. It's quite clear that our officers are supposed to use deadly force only when faced with a dire situation. And it's very hard for any of us to see that that standard was met here. The sergeant involved last night had the training. He had the tools to deal with this situation in a different manner. Commissioner O'Neill made this very clear earlier this morning. There was certainly protocol that called for deferring to the emergency services unit. That was not followed. There was obviously the option of using a taser. That was not employed. We will fully investigate this situation, and we will cooperate fully with any prosecutorial agencies. But we need to know why this officer did not follow his training and did not follow those protocols.
De Blasio says the city is going to deepen training around mental health. New York City's public advocate Tish James said we need to expand the use of non-lethal force and ensure that all NYPD officers are adequately trained. Furthermore, she says we need to explore options to better address emotionally disturbed individuals, such as sending out a trained medical professional with dispatched officers. Communities United for Police Reform says Danner's killing is yet another tragic example that training and changed rhetoric are no solution to the police violence killing and brutalizing Black and Latino people across the nation. The police reform group says it's troubling that this seems to be at least the seventh death of a New Yorker traditionally considered emotionally disturbed by the NYPD as a result of NYPD use of force or in police custody during the de Blasio administration. These deaths include Ronald Singleton, David Felix, Dennis Reyes, Mario Ocasio, Anthony Paul, and Richard Gonzalez. Turning to campaign news, this evening Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump and Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton will face off in their final debate before the election at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. The debate will have only one moderator, Fox News's Chris Wallace. Even though with Wallace, as Media Matters points out, there is a huge conflict of interest. Over the summer, Fox News's founder Roger Ailes was removed from his position. This as Fox's network chief following allegations from dozens of women he engaged in a pattern of workplace sexual harassment. Following Ailes's resignation, Wallace praised him as a mentor and personal friend. Ailes is now reportedly advising both the Trump campaign and Wallace's boss, Rupert Murdoch. And Wallace has claimed his role as moderator this evening is as a timekeeper, not as a truth squad. The Commission on Presidential Debates says the debate will consist of six topics: debt and entitlements, immigration, the economy, the Supreme Court, foreign hotspots, and fitness to be president. But as Adam Johnson, media analyst with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, tells us, those topics are very generic, with issues affecting the people throughout the U.S. largely left out.
They have to get in the entitlement reform, because we haven't had enough of those questions. We've had about three of those questions, so they need to get one more in. Immigration, the economy, which usually means tax cuts and jobs. Jobs is sort of an amorphous right-wing canard that has that is not necessarily tethered to any material benefit, but people like to discuss it as if it's something that can be created and taken away. And quote-unquote foreign hotspots, which I assume is going to involve some variation of us blowing away people far away. What won't be asked and what is never asked or what is yet to be asked about in all three of the debates, they have not asked a single question about gun control, education, student debt, poverty, drug policy, abortion, which is pretty shocking. There hasn't been a single question about abortion in any of the Democratic debates or the three GOP and Democratic debates for president. They haven't asked about surveillance, the NSA. They haven't asked about Native American issues, LGBTQ issues, and most shocking of all, and actually I'm pre-writing an article on this about how there hasn't been one question asked about climate change in any of the three debates. It is widely believed in some quarters that climate change obviously is the most existential issue of our time. It is not something that can be managed or ameliorated like debt entitlement reform or ISIS. It is something that will quite literally end life as we know it, and it's not something that's come up once. And I think that's a borderline scandal. Issues of race and racism and police brutality have come up quite a bit. In fact, they've come up in some variation in all three debates. Typically, however, they're framed in a very right-wing framing. They use terms that imply false parity, like race relations. Of course, the problem isn't race relations. The problem is white supremacy. The problem isn't racial tensions, it's racism. And so when Lester Holt asked those questions, he framed them in these kind of both sides kind of way. And then during the vice presidential debate, when they asked about racism, the question was actually, do we ask too much of our police officers? So while the issue of Black Lives Matter has been sort of touched upon, and it's been forced upon the media to talk about it by the nature of the protests and the unrest that have happened throughout the country, they kind of morph it into a either lukewarm liberal language or an overtly right-wing language that frames it as a war on the police, or frames it as some sort of competing equal sides of black and white as opposed to the system of white supremacy. So expect to maybe see another question about that. My guess is, since it's Fox, they may just avoid it altogether. And it isn't on the registrar of questions they're supposed to be asking. So, you know, look for more loaded questions about cutting Social Security. Don't look for questions about cutting military spending, because as we all know, it's those greedy grandmothers that are driving up our government spending, not the F-35 program that costs over $1 trillion. So that's kind of what I'm expecting.
And what about criminal justice reform?
Yeah, they almost certainly won't ask about criminal justice or prison reform. The largest prison strike in the country's history is currently going on. Estimated 24 prisons, thousands of prisoners. That, of course, won't be discussed. That also hasn't been discussed on MSNBC, the New York Times, the Washington Post. So that's another question that won't be addressed. We'll probably have our sixth question about Russia. The most popular question throughout the first two debates has been either Putin or Russia, followed by ISIS and terrorism, followed by tax policy. So the questions overwhelmingly focus on issues of government budget, which is usually code for entitlement reform, and national security issues. Iran, Assad have been mentioned throughout the debates by both the moderators and the candidates a total of 78 times, which is approximately 75 times more than climate change has been uttered, which is only three, all of which were uttered by Secretary Clinton, who only brought it up in passing. They'll bring up the obligatory ISIS conversation. That's kind of a gimme, especially since Wallace said he wants to talk about quote-unquote foreign hotspots. The irony is he's not talking about the global hotspot, which is climate change.
Adam Johnson, media analyst for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He says while we'll see mudslinging from Trump, even though he's no fan of Clinton, he says we won't see mudslinging from her because how can you sling mud at someone who is already drowning in it? In other campaign news, women in 15 cities around the country formed human walls around Trump campaign offices on Tuesday. They called on other women to reject the candidate and for more members of the Republican Party to withdraw their endorsements. Andrea Sears reports.
In New York, a multiracial group of women led by survivors of sexual assault formed a human wall outside Trump Tower in Midtown Manhattan. Bridget Flaherty helped organize a similar event last week in response to a videotape in which the Republican candidate had bragged about grabbing women's genitals. She says that protest inspired women around the country to stage actions.
We're standing up and fighting back. He will not become president, and women will literally determine the outcomes of this election because of the actions that we're taking.
The Tuesday event was timed to precede the final presidential debate. Donald Trump has insisted his comments were nothing more than locker room talk and has apologized for making them. Emma Bourbour, who helped organize a protest in Philadelphia, believes that while sexual assault survivors may be especially sensitive to the sorts of comments on the tape, virtually all women can relate to the effect sexism has on their everyday lives.
As a woman, I'm often made to feel like my body doesn't belong to me, whether that's walking down the street and a man yells out at me and acts like I'm basically just here for him, or a politician who thinks that he should be in charge of my medical choices.
The protesters are calling on members of the Republican Party to withdraw their endorsements of Donald Trump for president. Women's groups are already planning more protests to take place before Election Day, but Flaherty points out that no matter who wins on November 8th, the organizing will go on.
We know we are going to need pressure from women of color, from immigrants, from queer folks to continue to push our country to do better, because rape culture is a bipartisan problem.
For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
Stay tuned for a pre-debate special beginning at 7 p.m. with WBAI's Katie Halper. And then, of course, we will be broadcasting the debate. This is WBAI in New York. You're listening to our evening news. Besides the races this election season, there are ballot measures around the country being watched as barometers of the nation's mood. Ballot initiatives which could serve as laboratories in other states. Beth Schwartzapfel is with the Marshall Project, which focuses on criminal justice. She says politicians tend to be hesitant in the reforms they implement because they are afraid of being Willie Horton. Horton, convicted of murder, was sentenced to life in a Massachusetts prison, but was granted a weekend furlough only to commit more crimes. Schwartzapfel says politicians are afraid of passing reforms.
That if they pass reform efforts that are seen as, you know, not tough enough on crime, that can come back to bite them later. And even in 2016, when everybody's talking about criminal justice reform, especially in local races, that can really be an issue. Law and order rear its head as a campaign issue even now. So what happens with these ballot initiatives is that, you know, they sort of bypass the legislative process to a certain extent and ask the voters directly what they want to do. So in a way, it allows for more bold and more innovative criminal justice policy changes when you take them right to the voters. So, for instance, in Oklahoma, which is a relatively conservative state as these issues go, voters are considering whether to make all drug possession a misdemeanor instead of a felony. That's, you know, any amount of drugs that's for personal use, and that's any drugs, including heroin, would be a misdemeanor not a felony.
Oklahoma has the second highest incarceration rate in the country after Louisiana.
And they also have the highest incarceration rate of women. And women tend to serve time, when they serve time, it tends to be for nonviolent crimes like drug possession. So this is, in a certain way, targeted towards those problems.
And the ballot initiative is being supported by about 75% of the people in Oklahoma. Those on the left, like the ACLU, are supporting the measure for humanitarian reasons. Those on the right support it as a way of cutting back on big government and wasteful spending through incarcerating people who are not a danger. North Dakota has been in the news with protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline, but there is a ballot initiative there and in South Dakota and Montana, which would protect crime victims. This is through a national organization called Marcy's Law, which is bankrolled exclusively by a billionaire businessman, Henry Nicholas, who lives in California.
It's named for the sister of this guy, Henry Nicholas. Her name was Marcia Lee Nicholas. She was Henry's sister. And in the 80s, she was tragically killed by her boyfriend. And what happened was the family ran into the man who killed her in the supermarket. They had not been alerted that he had been released on bail. And that experience prompted this brother, Henry Nicholas, to become something of a crusader for victims' rights.
What this bill does is it turns anyone who suffers a criminal act into a victim, and the law is troubling to advocates for criminal justice reform. One problem is that it interferes with the presumption of innocence.
When you identify a victim from minute one, victims are in these amendments given the right to testify at bail hearings, for instance, about how this person affected their life and how the crime affected their life. Well, what defense lawyers say is, at that stage, nobody's been convicted of anything. So to have a victim get up there and talk about how this person did something to them, that's not been proven in a court of law. And so that affects somebody's presumption of innocence. And the same can be said throughout the course of the trial. If you have somebody who's been formally identified as a victim by the court, well, that does impact the perception of the person's presumption of innocence, and to a certain extent, the state's is not treating them as if they're innocent if they have a victim who's been identified by the state in these proceedings.
Another problem is the question of whose interests a law like Marcy's Law would benefit.
The typical victim of violence in this country is a young black man. Yet when you look at these victims' rights initiatives, they're almost always pushed by coalitions of white people, more or less. And so a lot of the young black men who are victims of violence have had convictions or arrests on their records in the past, and that makes it a lot harder for them to access victim services in a lot of cases. And so when these laws are crafted, it's rarely with the most common victims of violence in mind. And so there have been a number of groups that have sprung up in the last couple of years that are made up of these, you know, communities of color who suffer victimization at very high rates, who are raising questions about, you know, whose best interests these kind of groups and these kind of initiatives have in mind.
Beth Schwartzapfel is with the Marshall Project. Nicholas has spent almost $2.5 million on the North Dakota measure alone. We'll examine more ballot initiatives in the future. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, October 19th, 2016. The news was produced with Daniel Johnson, Andrea Sears, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.